If I had a dollar for every time someone said to me, "I don't go to church because I don't like being told what to believe," I would have enough money by now to retire at the ripe old age of 40, which is not long off for me. There are an awful lot of free thinkers out there who surprisingly think in the exact same way as a lot of other free thinkers out there. And it makes you wonder who told them to believe that if they were to go to church, they would all be told what to believe, right? And if I had a dollar for every time someone said to me, "I don't go to church anymore because I'm basically a Buddhist now," you all, I would straight up be a millionaire. I'm pretty sure I would have enough money to not only retire at the age of 40, but I would have enough money to retire on a yacht. Oh, that sounds nice. Now, the thing that's both funny and actually kind of alarming to me is that I have the same exact question for all of these quasi-Buddhist folks that I pose to them, and all of them, every single time, respond with the same exact sort of response. I'll start off by telling them that I think that their discovery of Buddhism is really great, and I genuinely mean that. If I weren't a Christian, I would be a Buddhist myself. There's some days I think I'm far more Buddhist than I am Christian. I think many people in my parish would be inclined to agree. And I even tell these folks that I personally believe, that both Hinduism and Buddhism and some Eastern spirituality has heavily influenced our own Christian scriptures and tradition. I just don't preach that very often because I don't want to get in trouble with the man in the pointy hat, right? But I do believe that personally. But then I go on to ask them, "So what sangha are you going to?" Or to put it in our language, I ask them, "What Buddhist church are you going to?" And their response is always, And then I ask, "Wait, isn't the Sangha one of the three jewels of Buddhism? And aren't the three jewels of Buddhism, you know, pretty much the core of what Buddhism is all about? I mean, as a Buddhist, isn't the whole idea of taking refuge in the three jewels of the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha pretty central?" And again, their response is always something like, "Okay, so yeah, you're not really a Buddhist then, right? You don't really practice what you preach, right? It's just a funny thing because your reasons for leaving the church where you're getting sick of being around people who don't practice what they preach." I am reminded yet again this morning of that saying, that great saying from the ancient desert fathers and mothers, and I've said it multiple times, and I'll say it again multiple times. If you see someone trying to climb up to heaven all by themselves, grab them by the heel and pull them back down again. If you see someone trying to meditate or trying to practice mindfulness or trying to practice Zen all by themselves, completely detached from the context of a religious community or a sangha or a church or a fellowship or what have you, grab them by the heel and pull them back down to reality again. For there is no such thing as solo spirituality. It's a delusion. You cannot do this work, the work of prayer, the work of meditation, the work of deep spiritual transformation, the work of union with God and union with the cosmos, whatever you want to call it. You cannot do this work without the aid of others, without journeying alongside others, without the distractions of others, without being inconvenienced by others, without being frustrated by others. It's all a part of the work. You cannot do this work without community. Community who's walking alongside you in this work. "Yeah, but Father TJ, the church is just an oppressive institution," someone will say to me. And you know what? Most days I am inclined to agree with them. the church at large has been, and it continues to be, an oppressive presence in our society and in our world to many, many, many people. It's true. There is no denying that. But here's the thing, my friends. First off, not all churches are the same. To conclude that every Christian and every church is basically the same, basically as equally as oppressive as all of the others, well, that's a pretty judgmental thing to conclude. At which point, you're being no different than all of those judgmental Christians that you've sought to distance yourself from. And also, like, if your aim is to leave behind every institution that has ever oppressed people, like, you would have to get into a spaceship and leave this planet, right? Because institutions are filled with people, screwed up, fucked up people like you and like me. It is part of it. So you can get in a spaceship and leave the planet, or you can embrace a different attitude. Now, if you grew up in a home where your parents' marriage failed, you can either decide that marriage just doesn't work, that it's an oppressive institution that fails people, or you can decide that if you are to get married someday, you can do it differently. You don't have to live in that shadow of that failed relationship, that failed institution. You don't have to do it the way that your parents did. You can do your best to redeem the narrative about marriage, to actually embody everything that the institution of marriage is meant to be about. It's no different with religion. It's the reason why I'm a priest. I'm trying to redeem the narrative, trying to change things, right? I find that it's awfully lonely work because not many people are actually willing to do it. And lastly, and most importantly, if you're someone that thinks that the church is just a really oppressive thing, just wait. Just wait until you come face to face with your own shadow self as you engage in your little meditation or prayer practice all by yourself. Things aren't going to be so zen anymore for you. It's not without good reason that for thousands of years in the Christian tradition, monks could not leave their religious communities behind to go and live lives of solitude as hermits, off in the wilderness or the desert. They first had to prove themselves for years in the context of community. Meditation and solitude are a dangerous, dangerous combination for those who are not equipped to handle it. But the problem is that the vast majority of people were unequipped to handle it. But we're choosing to basically live a hermit type of life anyways, doing things on our own, flying solo when it comes to our own spirituality. Thank you very much. Most people are not equipped to handle it. And they end up not only damaging themselves spiritually, but also emotionally and psychologically, because they don't have the training or the tools or the support to process all of the dark things, all of the inner demons that come bubbling up out of the subconscious mind. My friends, we cannot find union with the divine, union with the universe, by disconnecting from everyone and by disengaging everything. Because everything is connected. We all have what Thich Nhat Hanh called interbeing. May he rest in peace. To be is to interbe. To be is to be already in relationship. As someone from our tradition has said, at my birth, I am already in community. I'm not born first and then relate later. I am born, birthed into, by community. To be is to be relationally. As St. Thomas Aquinas has said, the perfection of any one thing, considered in isolation, is actually an imperfection. For one thing is merely one part of the entire integrity of the universe, arising from the assembling together of many singular perfections. In other words, everything is connected. So to attempt to climb up the ladder of heavenly perfection or meditative perfection or contemplative perfection all by oneself, that's actually an imperfection. For you're focusing on one part to the detriment, the exclusion of every other part. You can't get to ultimate connection, ultimate union, the unitive state, by disconnecting yourself completely from others, or for religion, for that matter. Yes, you may be able to make it to the base of the mountain, and yeah, you may be able to get a clear view of the peak as you are looking up at it from down below, but you'll never know what the view from the summit actually looks like, what it means to look down from the heights. Somewhere around the year 250 AD, Saint Cyprian said something that I find to be really fascinating. I just came across this quote this past week. When talking about people who have left the church, Cyprian didn't call them heretics or sinners or blasphemers or evil or anything like that. Instead, he simply said that they had forfeited their lived experience of the Trinity, of the fullness of God. For the ancient Christians, the Trinity was not what it is, what it means to most of us today. Like, it wasn't just a confusing doctrine or a dogma or a confusing math equation, right? How can God be both one and three? It wasn't like that for them. No, for these ancient Christians, the Trinity was something to be experienced, not just something to be thought about, right, or confused about. Trinity was the name that they gave to the multifaceted experience of God, the full experience of God. Even though these ancient Christians experienced God's presence in Jesus Christ, they understood that God's presence wasn't limited to Jesus Christ. The presence was still bigger than him. And even though these ancient Christians experienced the presence of God deep down within their own hearts, they understood that the presence of God wasn't limited to their hearts. There was also something utterly transcendent, other, about this presence as well. These early Christians discovered that God was, one, utterly beyond them, but that he was also present in the sacrament, in the trees, in the flowers, in the birds, in the faces of everyone around them. But they also knew that God was present in the depths of their own souls. God above, God all around, God within. God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. Saint Cyprian said that we can only come to this experience of God, this multifaceted experience of the divine, through the church, through the gathered prayerful community. Outside of the church, someone might be able to experience God in one of these ways, but not in the multifaceted, comprehensive, all-encompassing way that the saints all talked about. The church, mysteriously, somehow it wasn't just a symbol for the Trinity, but it also manifested the Trinity in the gathered community. It was in the church, in gathering together with other people, that people were mystically enabled to see just how all-encompassing God's presence truly is. They were enabled to see just how much God's Spirit has interwoven herself into the very fabric of the entire world, the entire universe. Everything became a sacrament of the divine to these folks. Think of like the followers of Saint Benedict as another example. After living together in community, people would eventually be able to see that in the face of every visitor, in the face of every stranger, in the face of their abbot, Christ was somehow mysteriously present to them. And Benedict even taught that every object on the property, everything from like flowers to kitchen spoons, was to be treated as if they were all as sacred as the consecrated bread and wine on the altar, because they were that sacred. In other words, it was through praying and meditating with others in community that people were empowered to see that everything and every person is a sacrament of Christ, a sacrament of God. As we here at St. Paul's kick off another season, an ecumenical season, where we focus on creation care and ecological justice, along with many other traditions and parishes, I want to say two things to conclude the sermon. First, for those of you listening to me at home, if your only experience of church is the experience of listening to me or someone like me through a podcast, through your earbuds, through your phone, or what have you, you need to know it's not enough. It's not enough. This is me lovingly grabbing you by the heel, lovingly inviting you to, you know, get off the couch, go outside and reconnect with other people, pray with other people. Do it regularly. You need it. In reconnecting with other people, you will deepen your connection to Mother Earth and God's presence within her. And if you don't believe me, prove me wrong. Go try it for yourself and see what happens. And you know what? You need people like the lovely people in the pews at St. Paul's here. And perhaps even more importantly, they need you. And if you don't come to St. Paul's, I know many of you listening are all over the place, find a place to go to if you haven't. You need people, and they need you. Your vision of God will be incomplete without them. And in a way, their vision of God will be incomplete without you. Without you being your own unique icon of Christ, their vision of God will be incomplete without your presence amongst them. For the rest of us here, those of us here in the pews, in this sanctuary, who come week in and week out, as we seek ecological justice and healing for Mother Earth, what is needed is not just activism or better policies or better laws. Yes, those things are needed too. But they don't touch the core. Those are just the symptoms of the disease, not the disease itself. What is needed, most of all, is a new vision of creation, a new relationship with Mother Earth. We need to not just see her as a planet, this place that we live on, right? We need to see her as a sacrament of the divine, a conduit of the divine. We need to see in Mother Earth what we see in the bread and the wine on the altar each week. We need to see in her the Christ that we see in each other every week. And we will learn how to see Mother Earth in this way if we open our hearts as wide as we possibly can every single time we step foot inside of this sacred space and participate in this historic liturgy. For Mother Earth is profoundly present in this sacred space, in these rituals, and in this liturgy, in this Eucharist. For those who have the eyes to see, the liturgy is a microcosm of Mother Earth's rhythms and beauty. What is needed is love. It is through showing up and loving Christ in each other that we will learn how to show up for Mother Earth and love the presence of Christ in her as well. environmental activists have been saying for decades, decades, that we won't be able to heal the rift between humanity and Mother Earth if we don't first turn and face and heal the rift that exists between human beings and other human beings. And these activists, they're right. They have been right all along. As St. Paul once said, Mother Earth has been eagerly waiting for the children of God to be revealed. Eagerly groaning, waiting for these children to be revealed. In other words, Mother Earth has been waiting in eager anticipation for us to finally become what we are. For when we become what we are, we quit forgetting who we are. When we become what we are, we allow Mother Earth to be what she is and everything she desires to be for us. What is needed is connection, love, passion, right? For Mother Earth and for people again. Not this individualistic, numb, deincarnated way of life that is now the American way of life. St. Thomas Aquinas once said that God created the whole universe. The reason why the universe exists, why this world exists, God did it so that all of us human beings would look at Mother Earth, look at this universe, look at this beautiful planet on which we live, and get drunk off of her beauty. My friends, it's time to get drunk off of this beauty once again.